All right, Shalom, everybody, welcome back to part three. So what we're going to do here now is we're going to shift gears from Yeshua's rulings, and we're going to start looking at Paul's writings and the rulings of Paul. Now, why is it important to look at Paul? Did Paul did he reverse any of the rulings of Yeshua? Did he override him? No, he didn't. We've got to understand is that Paul is dealing with a different crowd. Whereas Yeshua was dealing with people in Judea who were controlled by the Judean, the Pharisaic and Sadducean court system by the Sanhedrin. Paul, on the other hand, is dealing with people outside of the land who are under Greco-Roman law, and therefore they have different ways to get divorces, different ways of performing the divorces, different rulings about the ketubah and whatnot. And also Paul is dealing with people who were former Gentiles and now are coming into the Israelite faith, whereas Yeshua is speaking to people who are, already in the faith. And so Paul faces some different situations that we need to look at. So the first thing we need to understand is that in the Greco-Roman world, if a couple wanted to get divorced, there was no need to go out and get a divorce certificate. There was no need to do anything formal. The only time they would actually involve the courts at all is if there was a dispute over money. All that a person had, if I wanted to divorce my wife in the Greco-Roman world, all I would have to do is tell her to get out, right? If I tell her to leave and she leaves, we are legally divorced in the Greco-Roman world. And divorce was so common in that world that it was actually already anticipated in the marriage contracts. They were actually written in the language that the marriage would end in divorce and not in death. And we can actually see this in I've got an example here for you that was kind of interesting. This is on page 191. If you have the book, you can check it out here. This is a funeral inscription from a funeral in the late first century of the before the Common Era. And it says, "Uncommon are marriages which last so long, brought to an end by death, not broken apart by divorce. For it was our happy lot that it should be prolonged to the 41st year without estrangement." So, that's kind of interesting. In that Greco-Roman world, 41 years of marriage was basically very far out of the norm. And you look at America today, that's kind of the way that marriages are heading. Most, it's over 50% of marriages that end in divorce. And I think I quoted this stat earlier. But that number is actually going down simply because people are just not choosing to get married anymore. So a lot fewer people get married. Jewish marriages, on the other hand, were actually based on a concept of bondage to each other. The couple is legally bound to each other, whereas in Greco-Roman marriages, they were considered their own separate entity and they could kind of do what they wanted. So, what are the effects on the believer in Paul's time? Well, let's say that the wife decides to convert to faith in Yeshua in the Israelite system, right? And her husband decides he doesn't want to do that. What would he do? Well, most likely he was going to want to divorce her now because she's going to start doing some really weird things, keeping Passover and all this weird, crazy weird stuff. So does she have any way to stop him? Because now that she believes in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and in Yeshua, she now doesn't think that she should get a divorce because that's not God's will. Well, she doesn't have any say. The husband can simply get up and walk out and leave. And where does that leave her, right? Now she doesn't have a divorce certificate. She doesn't have legal grounds for divorce yet. And what is her how is she able to deal with this on a legal basis and on a spiritual basis. So that's where that's where Paul's writings come in, is that he's specifically trying to address this crowd of people here. So let's start off by reading Paul's writings in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1 through 9. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1 through 9. And he writes, "And concerning the matters he wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of whoring, let each one have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with agreement for a time to give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again so that Satan does not try you because of your lack of self-control. And I say this as a concession and not as a command, for I wish that all men were even as myself. But each one has his own gift from Elohim, one in this way and one in another. And I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they remain even as I am. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn." So, you know, once again, let's break this down and analyze what is being said here. First off, this statement, it is not good for a man to touch a woman, doesn't seem to be something that Paul is trying to tell them. It seems to somehow be this Corinthian, the slogan of this assembly in Corinth. So, you know, Paul is now trying to combat some of these strange doctrines that are creeping in. And this one really has kind of the underlyings of like a pre-Gnostic doctrine that would be have been taught. He also talks about, you know, the man has authority over the wife's body, and the wife has authority over hers or his, right? And so what is Paul trying to get across here? He's trying to get across that, that you know, you should not have a marriage that is full of abstaining from intimate relationships. But he's also kind of going against, you know, the rabbis, because remember, the rabbis basically ruled you have to come together in intimacy, you know, X number of times a week, depending on your occupation. Whereas Paul is saying, you know, I'm not going to make it a demand. You still, you know, you've got to earn it, but, you know, you've got to do it out of love and not withhold from doing that for whatever reason. You need to... you know, work things out. You know, Paul's saying you need to work things out because otherwise, what does that lead to? It leads to sexual immorality. And, you know, and actually, even when you look at what Paul is saying there, Paul is not saying that you should avoid marriage because it's a sin, because he acknowledges that non-marriage is the doorway to sexual sin. So how do we deal with this? Well, you know, Paul's saying, well, I wish that everyone could remain as me. This has been kind of baffling to scholars. And what the general consensus is that in the city of Corinth at the time, it's documented around that time period that there was a very great famine in the land. And so, you know, what happens in a marriage? Well, you get married and you have kids, and now you've got more mouths to feed. And now the husband has to be worried not only about taking care of himself, but about taking care of someone else too. So, you know, it seems to be that Paul is just saying, you know, these times are hard. There's not a lot of food. You know, let's kind of be a little bit more reasonable about it. So that's their best explanation. That, you know, the other explanation is that maybe Paul just enjoyed a life of being single. Either way, obviously, he's not saying that it's a command not to get married, because otherwise, you know, Israel would have died out in the wilderness because they're not reproducing, right? So, and we can look at the temple system to see. I mean, the high priests, all the priests were allowed to get married. So obviously, Marriage does not reduce your holiness status. It was simply something that Paul was putting out for whatever his own reasons were. We can also see further evidence of this in the same chapter, verse 25 through 26. Let's read that really fast. Verse 25 through 26. And concerning maidens, I have no command from the master, but I give judgment as one whom the master in his compassion has made trustworthy. I think then that this is good because of the present necessity that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Right? He speaks of the present necessity. Obviously, there was something going on there that made it seemingly important not to get married for whatever reason, be it the famine or whatever the other reason might have been. And then let's read verse 32 through 35. And I wish you to be without concern. He who is unmarried is concerned about the matters of the master and how to please the master. But he who is married is concerned with the matters of the world, how to please his wife, about the matters... there is a difference between a wife and a maiden. An unmarried woman is concerned about the matters of the master, so that she might be set apart in both body and in spirit. But she who is married is concerned about matters of the world, how to please her husband. And I say this for your own good, not to put restraint on you, but for what is proper, and to attend to the master without distraction. So another possible explanation here, and you can see this throughout all the first century writings, they were expecting Yeshua to return in that generation. I fully believe that it can be shown that they did not expect there to be 2,000 years. That's something, between the death of and resurrection of Mashiach and his return. So, it's possible that with everything going on, that Paul thought that he was in those last days. And so what he was saying is that, should we be more concerned with making sure that we are a bride prepared or with matters of this world? But either way, we can see that in today's society, being married and having children is a good thing because, we have to do this in order, not just to, to promulgate, our faith through future generations. But we learn so much from our children. I have three wonderful little boys. And I'll tell you what, I probably learn more from Torah, from raising them and learning from them than I do from everything else, because God gave them to us as a gift. In order for us to better understand spiritual things, for us to understand our relationship with Him and why He punishes us and all that stuff. So, I really do believe that Paul here is concerned with things that are greater than what we actually, may think was going on there. So let's continue reading in verse 10 through 15 now of that same chapter. And to the married I command, not I, but the master, a wife should not separate from a husband. But if she indeed is separated, let her remain unmarried or restored to favor with her husband, and let a husband not send away the wife. And to the rest I say, not the master, if any brother has an unbelieving wife, and she thinks well to live with him, let him not send her away. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband, and he thinks it well to live with her, let her not send him away. For an unbelieving husband is set apart, or has been set apart in the wife, and an unbelieving wife has been set apart in the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are set apart. And if an unbelieving one separates, let him separate himself. A brother or a sister has not been enslaved to such matters, but Elohim has called us to peace. Okay, So let's go ahead and analyze what's being said here. First off, is that we have to understand in the Greco-Roman world, there wasn't one single term or just a couple single terms for divorce. There was actually over 50 documented terms that were used for divorce. So when Paul talks about them being separated, he's talking about the Greco-Roman style of divorce where the person would just simply walk out of the house and no longer be married. And so what Paul is saying here is that in the cases where a believer is married to an unbeliever, if they can live peaceably together, then, you know, they should do that. And he says, because, you know, the husband is sanctified in the wife, and the wife is sanctified in the husband, right? So what's to say that you, you know, through your belief, you're not going to save them? Now, where is he getting that that understanding from? Is that in the Torah? I believe, personally, where he's getting that from is the story of Rechab and Jericho, right? Because of Rechab's belief, she makes a covenant with the two men, the two spies, and they tell her as long as she remains in her house, much like the Passover ritual, as long as she remains in her house, she and anyone in that house are now protected from the evils, from the destruction, right? That's not to say that those people who came into her family members who came in that house with her, they didn't believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They didn't protect those spies, but they believed in her. They, by coming into her house, that was an ancient Near Eastern form of covenant making. And so when they came into her house, they were essentially in covenant with her, and therefore they were protected. You know, we can see the same thing in the story of the flood, right? We've got eight people in the ark. We're all eight people perfectly righteous and perfect believers in Yahweh. Well, obviously not, because as soon as they get out of the ark, you know, we have problems with Ham, and he's either doing something with his father or possibly sleeping with his mother. So there is obviously a bad seed in the ark there, but because they're in covenant, you know, now they are protected because of that. So I believe that's what Paul is saying here, is that his belief is that if, you know, you're a believer and your spouse is not, that it is possible and even probable, according to Scripture, that your spouse may make it in the kingdom, even if they themselves are not a believer, as long as they remain in that house with you, and as long as they remain in that covenant with you, then now they are brought along for the journey. You know, he also talks about if you've been divorced, you should leave yourself available for reconciliation if that is at all possible, because it's better to be reconciled to each other than to go through that divorce. He also clearly states that the believer should not be the one to initiate that divorce. Now, is he saying that a believer can never get divorced? No, obviously Yeshua already said, you know, cases of adultery, and then it's implied by his not speaking on it, not covering it, you know, mentioning it at all, that cases of spousal abuse are valid terms for a divorce. Now let's look at one of the terminology, the terms used here. Bound. Why am I missing that? Okay, because, you know, I'm using the Scriptures version, and it's translated a little bit differently. Let's look at verse 15, and we're going to switch over to the New King James. And it says, "But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but Elohim has called us to peace." Now, that seems, you know, kind of a little weird, given the context of what's going on here. But we have to understand, remember what I talked about, Jewish marriage contracts were based off of the concept of bondage. And we also, have comparable phrases used. The common phrase used in a Jewish divorce, a get, a bill of divorce, was I divorce you, you are free to marry another. Essentially, you are no longer in bondage. So they're basically saying it, that you're now free to marry whomever you choose. And so what Paul is trying to say here, and we can see this also in verse 27. Verse 27, it says, "Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Do not seek a wife," right? So this term of bondage is speaking of marriage. And so when Paul writes here, if an unbeliever departs, which is Greco-Roman divorce, he's saying, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. So what Paul is saying here is that if you were basically divorced against your, if, Greco-Roman style divorced against your will, Paul is saying that his judgment is that is not, or that is now legal grounds for divorce according to the Torah. And what he's probably basing that off of is probably based off of Exodus 21, which would be, if they leave, they're no longer supporting you with food, clothing, and love. So it's essentially abandonment and abuse, which would give you the right, according to the Torah, to divorce. So what about that term? God has called us to peace. David Enstone Brewer argues that this is a pragmatic solution, that divorce is valid, even though it is not scriptural, since this partner is refusing to act in accordance with scripture. And, most people, I think, can really, kind of agree on that. That, if is it justice that if your husband or if your wife leaves you because they're an unbeliever and they don't agree with what you're doing, is it now justice that you now be bound to a life of singleness because of the sins of another person? No. So Paul here is arguing in his own way of arguing that in cases of abandonment marriage where you are not the one who divorced them, that you are now legally free from that marriage contract, and you're now free to marry another. So let's finish up here by looking at a couple more verses. We're going to read 1 Corinthians 7, 25 through 38. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the master. Let me switch versions back here. But I give judgment as one whom the master in his compassion has made trustworthy. I think then that it is good because of the present necessity, or we talked about that, there's something going on in Corinth at the time, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But even if you should marry, you have not sinned. If a maiden should marry, she has not sinned. But such shall have pressure in the flesh, and I would spare you. And this I say, brothers, the time is short. So even from now on, even those who have wives, should be as though they had none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use this world as not misusing it. For the scene of this world is passing away, and I wish you to be without concern. He who is unmarried is concerned about the matters of the master, how to please the master. But he who is married is concerned with the matters of the world, how to please his wife. And there is a difference between a wife and a maiden. An unmarried man is concerned, unmarried woman is concerned about the matters of the master, that she might be set apart both in body and in mind. But she is married, is concerned about the matters of this world, how to please her husband. And I say this for your own good, not to put a restraint on you, but for what is proper, and to attend to the matters of the master without distraction. And if anyone thinks he is behaving improperly toward his maiden, if she is past the flower of her youth, so it should be, let him do as he desires. He does not sin, let them marry. But if he stands steadfast in his heart, and has having no necessity and authority over his own desire, and has so decided in his heart to guard against his own maiden, does well. So then, he who gives her in marriage does well, but he who does not give her in marriage does even better. A wife is bound by Torah as long as her husband lives. And if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she desires, but only in the master. She is better off if she remains as she is, according to my opinion, and I think I have the spirit of Elohim. Right, so right there we have some interesting rules of Paul here, right? First off, you know, he's saying this is my opinion, and he thinks he has the spirit of Elohim, but again, it's his opinion in Scripture that he's recording here. So you know, we've got to look at what Paul is really trying to say here. First off, he's not condoning, but he's not promoting Levirate marriage. And why is that? Because Levirate marriage is concerned specifically with the land. And an inheritance in the land, and they're outside of the land. They don't have possession in the land. So if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she desires. She doesn't have to marry her brother because there's no inheritance. So is Paul doing away with the Torah? No. Paul is not doing away with the Torah. He's simply stating that the fact of the matter is that the Torah is there to promulgate your royal land grant of the land. If you don't have possession in the land, you don't have a royal land grant, there's no point in having that Levirate marriage. And then the other thing to pick up is that, you know, he writes, only in the master. And this right there is implying then that that she is really only to marry a believer in Yeshua, right? When we go out and we pick a partner, it shouldn't be after the lusts of our own heart. You know, we need to pick a partner who is a like believer. And, you know, obviously, if they're a Christian or if they're a Jew, they are a like believer. They believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, obviously, it's probably better, you know, if you do marry a Messianic, and I'm definitely not saying you should go marry someone and convert to Judaism, but, you know, if you love someone, as long as they love God themselves, you can have your theological differences. But, you know, what Paul would be saying here is basically don't go out and go marrying a Muslim. Don't go out and marry a Buddhist, right? Because when you marry them, now you're coming into covenant with their pagan gods. And you know, if you look into Islam, if you marry someone in Islam, you have to convert to Islam, right? So, right there, you know, Paul is saying you don't do that sort of a thing. And then the last thing that Paul here is arguing is that, you know, if a wife is bound to the Torah as long as her husband lives, how much more someone who's a widow, right? If a woman who's divorced, you know, he's basically trying, it's that whole kol vahomer issue, right? If someone is no longer bound to that marriage contract, They have just as much right to get remarried as anyone else does. A widow, who, they don't have to perform that levirate marriage, they have just as much right to remarry as anyone who is divorced does, in accordance with what he was talking about earlier on. So to kind of conclude everything here on the words of Paul, what was Paul trying to relay in his message to the Corinthians here? What he was trying to say is that we should all we really should never strive for divorce. So a believer should never divorce their spouse unless there's strife in that marriage, if there's physical or emotional abuse, abandonment, or obviously marital infidelity. That's obviously your right to divorce them, but other than that, they should not divorce. But he was also saying, because we live out in this Greco-Roman world, and your spouse can just up and divorce you for any reason, and doesn't have to go through the court system, that it's not fair to you that because of someone else's sin and someone else's unbelief, that now you're stuck with the burden of living your life without another, without a partner. And so, essentially based off the principle of abandonment, Paul rules that in those cases, that is a valid divorce, and therefore the woman is free to marry another. However, he does put out right from the get-go that reconciliation in a marriage is always preferential to going on with that divorce. So that's going to wrap it up with this series here. I had been kind of tempted to go into discussing kind of women's rights and some of the harder principles or harder things that Paul talks about with regards to women. But there's just so much controversy in there. But I do want to kind of leave you with thinking about something. We know that in the Greco-Roman world, there was a lot of cultic paganism. Cultic prostitution, and it's actually believed that once in every girl's life they were required to go to the temple and perform an act of ritual prostitution. And also we know that there were female domination cults where basically females were worshipped as goddesses essentially. And so the males in Corinth were actually very dependent on these females in their worship and everything. So, with that in mind, we've got to kind of try to take that context to the words of Paul. When he says women should be silent in the congregation, is there anything in the Torah that says women aren't allowed to speak in church or in the assembly or anywhere? No, but he's dealing with certain problems there. So, if you're looking at that, I would highly recommend you go in and you look at the culture and you look at the customs and everything of the time just to kind of get a feel for what Paul is talking about. In the future, I may go into it, kind of depends. I may go into it back into this and do some teachings on kind of the biblical roles of men and women. But once again, that's kind of a hot button issue for a lot of people. And I would highly recommend you go out and you do your own research on that, and come to your own conclusions and be convicted of them and make sure that they line up with the Torah. Because that is our basis. That is our roots. Our roots are the Torah. And we've got to make sure that we're living our lives in accordance with the Torah, because the Torah is the constitution. It is the laws, the constitution of the kingdom, and it's what we should be basing our life off of. And following the Torah is the worship of Yahweh, and it is the worship of His Son Yeshua. Because remember, Yeshua is in perfect obedience to the Father. So, one other thing, I kind of mentioned this to begin with. I also do plan on in the future going in and looking at the metaphorical relationship of Yahweh as the husband of Israel, and looking at the divorce of the northern kingdom and taking all these principles that we've learned and applying it to that relationship so that we can get a better understanding. But there's some other groundwork I need to lay first in some other areas. And so that's the, you know, that's kind of the direction that will be going on from now. So, anyways, I really do, I hope and I pray that you have enjoyed this teaching. It's been my honor to bring the message of the King of the Universe regarding how we are to conduct our lives in our marriages, and also, you know, looking into all the cultural and the context of these things so that we could truly understand what is being said here. You know, please, if you have any questions, you can email me at rootedintorah@gmail.com. You can get on the Wisdom and Torah website and leave me feedback. I always appreciate feedback. It helps me become a better teacher. And if I've said anything wrong, please get on there and let me know so that I can correct it, so I can repent, so that I can make sure that my understanding is correct for my own self, and so that I can put out the correct information to all of you. So until next time, shalom.
He still speaks from heaven each and every day. I'll let